Orleans, the city that had existed in my head before this day, the place my parents had had their honeymoon. And I wondered, too, whatever happened to the postcard of Jackson Square. I thought of my mama telling me her last story so I'd know what I could of who I was, and there was the picture in my head, too, of Molly and Cathedral. These pictures came to me, stories of my own life, and how I'd taken hold of it by the throat, made it come around to what I could make it, how I'd fix things on my own. What all those pictures told me, what all the stories in my life said to me there in the cab of a truck, my baby in my arms, was that I could fix things. Though the world was falling down on itself, crumbling beneath us, I could fix things. I knew I could. The child in my arms, I decided then, there, that no one would ever use those two words, Mongolian idiot, to describe her in my presence, unless they wanted my full wrath down on them. What this child needed was my love, not my abandonment. I had lived that loss myself. No matter my baby wasn't normal as I'd been, was sick in some way I couldn't understand. No matter she was what the doctor figured on being only a burden. No matter he was already figuring on her dying. He didn't know me. Didn't know what I could live through. I could do it. I could fix things. My life, my children's lives, my husband's life. Brenda Kay's. And so on that drive home, me losing track of what town was which as we moved along the old road, Lester not having lit up a cigarette yet, both hands tight on the steering wheel, his knuckles white as the skin my dead daddy's had been, I tried out my words. I said, "We'll keep her." I said, "She'll be loved, no matter how long she lives." I said, "We can fix this, if everyone in this household gives her the love they've got, and all of it." I said, "We can fix this. We can." Leston finally turned to me. His eyes were wet, red, the hair tousled by the wind from his open window. Fear was on him now. Fear, like an open wound, fresh and raw. He swallowed. "Can we, Jewel?" I turned from him, my eyes back on the road. "You just get us on home." The days after New Orleans were days clouded over with grief, the house empty save for Brenda Kay and me, Annie out back and digging at sweet potatoes, the chore I gave her so that I could sit in an empty house with only my baby. Each and every day I sat in my rocker before the fireplace, holding tight to Brenda Kay, letting her nurse whenever she wanted to, my breast about the only gift I could give her. The curtains pulled closed since the afternoon we made it back from New Orleans. I wanted no light in here, wanted nothing, only the dark. Not one of those days went by without the idea in me of putting her away, of giving up whatever gift from God she was. That thought was with me even after the resolve to face this new and ugly world had come to me in the cab of the truck on the way home. I thought of giving her up each day. That word, institution, a curse and a means of escape at once, so that those two notions, the chains of a blessing from God and the means to escape that blessing, were like two huge and awful birds circling me, just waiting for my baby either to live or to die. And more times than I wanted during those days filled with the idea of escape, there came to me the memory of the one time I tried to leave the world God deemed the just and correct one for me. Too many times there came to me that night in late fall, only a few months before Bessie Swansea'd stolen away from me Cleopatra Sinclair. A night like any other, me wide awake in my bed, wondering exactly what I was doing there, which God, Missy Cook's or my own, whose plan for my life I was wandering through. We were in our courses then, taking arithmetic, Latin, grammar, music, all of us in our uniforms and in our assigned chairs and calling out present to each teacher, no matter if our minds were there or not. So far, the only class I'd really cared for was Latin, in the maze of conjugations and forms and history of the language. Some deep comfort, refuge from what kept going on every day here, me not being in charge of who I was and where I was going. One night, Cleopatra touched my shoulder. "Take what you want with you in your pillowcase." Neither her touch nor her words surprised me. All of it, only the next logical thing could happen in my life. Here'd come another chance to take charge of it, fix it. The notion big in me that I could grab my life and mend it in ways unimaginable in other people's heads. I sat straight up, quietly slipped off my pillowcase, pulled from between the mattress and the springs my tablet and pencil and my photograph, put them into the pillowcase, then reached under the bed and, without thinking of it, picked up my Bible. I eased out of bed and over to the pine dresser, pulled out the dress I'd worn in here that day in March, put it in the pillowcase, put on my jumper, then my coat, then picked up my shoes. By daylight, we were a few miles from Picayune, the two of them together a few steps ahead of me, the sun coming up behind us. Already my shins started to hurtin'. The step onto hard ties awkward, every tie too close together, every other tie too far apart. I was hungry, and my arm hurt from carrying the pillowcase, and my heart hurt, too, for not being in the midst of the two of them up there, in on whatever secrets they knew about the world and about each other, until finally I just stopped, moved off to the gravel beside the tracks and sat down. Bessie was first to turn around. She stared at me, pillowcase in hand, and then Cleopatra turned. Neither was smiling. I looked down at the gravel, took a handful of it in my hand, felt how cold it was, felt how hungry I was, felt how far we'd walked only to end up here. Nowhere I knew. A minute later they stood next to me, their black leggings and shoes right next to me, Cleopatra a few inches behind and to the side of Bessie. I looked up. "I'm hungry." I let a few pieces of the gravel slip between my fingers, disappear into all the rest of the gravel. "Or did you forget about that part of things?" Bessie stared at me, her eyes dead, as though she wished maybe I was too. "Didn't, not at all. There's a house ahead, not more than a mile. We'll eat there." She turned, moved ahead. Cleopatra stood next to me a moment more, her toe twisting another quick circle in the gravel. "Come on, girl." Before I looked up to see whose side she may have been on in all this, she'd turned, was already headed up the tracks. And there was a house up the tracks, just as Bessie'd said there'd be. We'd come around a wide bend, crossed a small trestle over a black backwater creek, and had come upon a small blue house, the roof all battered tin, the chimney puffing out smoke thick as gray cotton. As soon as we saw it, Bessie put up a hand to us, then turned, moved right past Cleopatra and me and back along the tracks. Cleopatra said, "What's going on?" Bessie said nothing, only walked, and of course we followed. When we got back to the trestle, Bessie stepped off the tracks and down the creek bank. She sat down a pillowcase, reached in and brought out the blue dress she'd worn her first day in at the school, and we knew what to do. Cleopatra and I moved down the bank too, opened our pillowcases, brought out our clothes. By then, Bessie'd already taken off a jumper and underdrawers and leggings and blouse so that she stood before us naked. I saw for the first time her breasts, how full and rounded they were, the nipples up and hard in the cool morning. And I saw the dark hair she had between her legs, the wisps of it thicker than mine. Then my eyes went to her belly and to two long scars there. They ran from just below her belly button up to her ribs, parallel to each other, and purple, and the width of a fingernail. And I couldn't help but shiver at what I saw and what I didn't know. I dropped my jumper, quick put on my old dress, hurried into my coat. I glanced over my shoulder once to see what Cleopatra was doing, saw her there in just her underdrawers and leggings, her back to us too, and she shimmied into a dress I recognized from nowhere. Then I remembered she'd been brought in before me. When she turned around, she'd become someone else altogether. The dress, A pink one with a white satin ribbon round the waist tied off in a bow was a little small on her, but every inch beautiful. Bessie was down on her knees now, and Cleopatra and I watched as she stuffed into her pillowcase the blouse, then the jumper, leggings, and underdrawers. She stood, went down to the water, brought back a big rock, moss-covered on top and muddy on the bottom, and dropped it into the pillowcase, then twisted the open end into a knot, lifted the bundle. "Won't ever be needing these again, that's for goddamn certain." She swung the bundle back, brought it forward, and let it sail out into the middle of the creek, where it hit with a loud splash and disappeared. She turned to us, smiling, and walked right between us, up the bank. Then she was up on the tracks. Cleopatra wouldn't look at me, and though she was first to follow Bessie, this time she hung back a few extra feet. The three of us spread out along the track, only two of us with pillowcases now, headed for that blue house with the tin roof. We squatted behind bushes next to the house. Bessie reached into him and pulled back a few branches, peered through. From where I sat, all I could see was smoke lift into clear blue air, disappear with the wind up there. Bessie turned to me, no smile now. "Now you find out why we took you on in this here little venture." She reached a hand over near my face. I flinched, pulled away quick, but a hand reached my face all the same, and she touched my cheek with the back of her fingers before I could do anything else. The touch was soft, and for a moment I wondered if she weren't thinking of her own face, her own skin, her breasts. I wondered how long she'd been trading on a face, that skin, her breasts, and the hair between her legs. Long enough, I realized, to end up with scars like she had. "Yes, ma'am, you little sugar tit, you ride along with us here because you come from money, you do." Slowly she took hold of my chin. "You come from money, ain't nobody in that shithole school don't know that. Now you going down round to the front door of that shanty, you're going to knock on that door, and when whoever it is lives there comes, you're going to engage them in some sorrowful story." She started holding tighter to my jaw, pressing hard on my chin, on my teeth, my mouth. "And they're going to believe you, they are, because you come from money and folks with none, where the niggers or crackers can smell it on those that do, and they'll believe whatever it is you have to say, because they can smell that money on you. They always do, and you telling your little story will divert their sorry-ass attention for a while. So you lie your sweet little virgin ass off at that door to whoever it is comes." She paused, held tight my chin a moment longer, then let it go. I took in a breath, looked at her. She smiled again, tucked a lock of hair behind my other ear. "Now you go." I did. Before I knew what was happening, I was coming round the front of the house. The blue clapboards I could see up close were ancient, the paint blistered and cracked and fallen off, and I was heading to the door, gray wood with only a small hole where a knob should have been. I knocked, and the door opened a moment later. There stood an old nigger woman, her hair white, skin black as any niggers I'd ever seen before, her eyes set deep in her head and even blacker than her skin. She had on a filthy apron, was wiping her thin hands with it. Before I could even open my mouth, she was smiling, and I knew what Bessie'd said was true. People without money believed the ones who had it, and I didn't even let her say one word to me as I started in on a story about how I was a little girl whose mother died recently and whose grandmama, who owned a mansion up in Purvis, had sent me down to New Orleans for a new dress and how a swindler had stolen all my money from me and how I had no other choice of getting back to Purvis than to walk. The nigger woman frowned, drew her eyebrows up, gave her face a tilt to one side, listening to it all, and she reached out a hand and touched my cheek. I didn't pull away. I only let her touch me, and for a moment as I went on with my story about how I needed help back in the right direction and how I would be able to give her a reward from my grandmama's cash box, I let my eyes close. The nigger woman's hard and callous fingers touched my cheek even more gently than Bessie'd done when she'd started giving my instructions, and suddenly I fell back into my own place in Purvis. Pictured in my mind Molly touching me. Pictured the old kitchen, the walls, the cupboards, the butcher block stained black with years of blood. I pictured all of that while I heard myself tell the story of a girl's mother dying of a fever in an upstairs bedroom. All this time my eyes were closed, the nigger woman's hand on my cheek, and I felt tears coming. Felt them spill out of my eyes and down the cheeks of a girl telling her story as a lie. None of it the truth, but the truth all the same. My story only to divert her sorry-ass attention for a while Bessie and Cleopatra did whatever it was they were going to do here. That was when I opened my eyes, the story of my life cut short by the sound of a pan knocked to the floor inside the shack, and the nigger woman brought her hand down from my face, turned to the inside of a house. There stood Cleopatra, holding a skillet with the hem of her pink dress. In the skillet, bacon frying up, eggs in there with it. Inside the room was only a fireplace, a metal grate of some kind hooked in them. On it, a battered and steaming black kettle. A busted-up chair leaned against one wall, a quilt heaped in one corner. I saw all this in an instant, the time it took the nigger woman to turn from me to a home. She turned back to me, and I saw in her puzzlement at what was going on here. From behind Cleopatra stepped Bessie, who looked first at the woman, then at me. "For God's sake, this here's just some old nigger shanty. We didn't even have to send you out on your story." She moved to the fireplace, with the hem of her own dress, took hold of the kettle. "Grits, much obliged." She turned, was gone out the back door. Cleopatra backed toward the door, disappeared. The nigger woman took a step toward the back door, but turned to me, looked at me, her face no longer filled with the puzzle of this all, but with the stunned and milky look of a dead animal's eyes. She just stood there, looked at me a long moment. I knew now of the world. I ran, took off round the back of a house, saw a pillowcase up on the rise where the tracks lay. When I got to it, I caught sight of the last bit of Cleopatra, saw her running into the woods on the other side of the tracks, the pan in hand. She'd already disappeared from the waist down for the brush back there. Bessie, I figured, was already buried. I held my pillowcase with both hands, turned to the shanty. The nigger woman stood just inside the back door, her hands at her sides, dead, useless. Because what, I thought, could she do? There was nothing. Three white girls had swooped in like chicken hawks and taken what they wanted at will. There was nothing she could do. Her life in our hands. But it was my own life in my hands I saw, and I felt how sorrowful my own story really was. Not the story of my family all dying around me. Not the story of being sent here by a grandmother who didn't give a damn about me. No, the sorrowful story I knew was that this was where I'd brought myself when I'd taken my own life into my hands. Come here to this moment, robbing a nigger woman of her food, then tearing off into the woods, which seemed like no way to fix a life at all. So I ran. I ran back in the direction we'd come. I made it to Picayune by noon. Stopped and slipped back into my jumper in somebody's privy not far from school. I walked right onto campus, strolled right into the dining hall, took my place in line. The girls all around me silent, staring at me at the pillowcase I carried, my mouth shut tight with what small piece I knew now of the world. Then came Miss Archibald's hand on my shoulder, fingers digging into my skin like talons, and I knew it was over. Miss Archibald pulled me out of line, pushed me through the girls swarming now, their words quiet murmurs, each whisper building one on another until the sound in the dining hall roared in my ears. She pushed me to the door, on out to the courtyard, across the lawn to the flagpole in front of the main building. I let go the pillowcase, let it settle next to my feet, and I bent at the waist. I hugged the flagpole, felt the cold steel of it press into my face, burn into my cheek. Tory came from inside the main building and down the steps, in his hand, the belt. I couldn't see or take it, only saw Tory step behind me with the belt, step back without it. Ms. Archibald lifted my jumper over my hips, and I pictured each girl at the school pressing her face to the glass windows of the dining hall imagined I could hear the talk they gave, though the only sound was the fall wind in the tops of trees, the whir and hiss of it. My eyes went to the blue sky above me, blue, deep, and still and cutting. I kept my eyes open as long as I could, focused on that frightening cold blue, until they blinked shut of their own when the belt finally came down on me. The snap of it was louder than I could have imagined, the pain of it shuddering up through the backs of my legs and into my stomach and my lungs and on into my face and out to my fingertips. But I kept my eyes on that blue the whole time, through each shock of the belt, through each wave of pain. It was that memory in my head to come back and haunt me each day I spent waiting, a haunting that kept me from the escape handing Brenda Kay over to an institution would be, and I found myself whispering out into the cold dark of the room, into the closed eyes of my baby daughter, whispering to myself and to all the ghosts that seemed to stay with me wherever this life led me. The words I whispered I'd heard most all my life, yet had never truly known until then precisely what they meant. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up into heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. I saw only then that perhaps those two great and ugly birds circling over us, those notions of escape and no escape, might actually be one and the same. One great and all-powerful being, my own God in heaven, waiting up there on high. But then one morning, 3 weeks after we came home from New Orleans, there came a knock on the door. I did nothing, only opened my eyes. I'd fallen near asleep in the rocker. Dr. Beaudry pushed open the door, poked his head in. He squinted into the darkened room, smiled.
"Mrs. Hilburn, you all right in there?"
I said nothing, didn't even rock the chair. He came in. The door stood open behind him, light falling in. I said, "Close the door. Just close it." He turned, slowly pushed it closed.
"Not too good for you, neither you nor your baby. This dark."
I gave myself a push in the rocker, started us in motion again. "If you're here to try and take away my baby, then you just might as well head out right now." Brenda Kay stirred, reached up. He looked at me a few moments.
"We don't want you to give up your baby, not if you don't want to. Dr. Baskett and I both want you to know that if you want to keep her, we will help in what ways we can."
I was quiet a while, the only sound my chair rocking on the hardwood floor. "And what ways might those be?"
"For one, I'd like to see her at least once a month, and every 3 months Dr. Baskett wants to take a good look at her. That's for starters. And there is a form of medication, calcium gluconate, a bone strengthener. One of the problems with Mongolian idiots."
I'd stopped the rocker without knowing I had. Felt myself holding Brenda Kay even tighter to me.
"Don't you ever say those words in front of me again. Don't you dare say those words."
He stared at me, then nodded, let his eyes fall from me.
"The injections help strengthen bones. Soft bones are one of the problems with..."
He paused, touched one ear with a hand, brought it back to his chin.
"With children of this special nature."
"Thank you." I closed my eyes. I pictured in my head that great bird circling higher and higher, up and away from us, disappearing high into a cold blue sky. Dr. Beaudry said,
"We need to talk about how much this entire procedure will cost."
I opened my eyes. "No, we do not." Leston spent his days combing the woods for lighted knots from all the splintered wood they'd blown up years ago. That business of hauling stumps for turpentine down to Pascagoula long dried up. The end of the war, the end of our money. Once the boys were home from school, the three of them, Leston, Burton, and Wilman, drove along dirt roads out to nigger shanties to sell them bundles of the kindling, just trying to make enough money for us to get by. There was no way on this earth he'd be caught selling to the whites in town. Just no way. Billie Jean, a year out of Purvis High, worked as a teller at First Mississippi downtown. She hated the work, but she was faithful to give up her paycheck to us, save for a dollar or two allowance we gave right back to her. My job was in the cafeteria at Bailey Grammar School, where I served up sweet potatoes and fried okra and on good days, a thin sliver of ham to all the children. At the end of the day, I was allowed to bring home a few servings of what little food was left. I was the only white woman at work there in the cafeteria, but that didn't bother me. It was the money we were after. Billie Jean hadn't subscribed to her magazines in 2 years. The last piece of new clothing I'd bought for myself was a scarf 3 years ago for when we went into New Orleans. The wind down there whipping sometimes too hard for me to stand. Toxie and J.E. and Garland and all the niggers were on their own now, playing pickup at whatever work they could find. Leston had sold off the equipment 4 years ago. Thursday night, Brenda Kay took her first step. She was 5 years, 6 months, and 4 days old when she'd finally taken her first step. My baby with the copper hair, leaving Billie Jean's arms and slowly doddering over the braided rug toward me across the front room from her. The night outside the open windows was filled with the whir of cicadas, tree frogs, all else that lived in the darkness and away from what was happening inside. The boys were up in their room, and I hoped, embarked on the nightly torture they believed homework only good for. Leston was at the kitchen table, quiet as always, hunched over a cup of coffee I knew had long gone cold. Anne lay before the empty fireplace on her tummy. Like every night, she finished her homework hours before dark, her legs crossed at the ankles, feet up in the air. In her hand was a thick red pencil, on the floor in front of her a tablet of paper so like the one I had when I was a child, I thought for a moment that indeed it was mine, misplaced ages ago and now miraculously appeared. But the miracle here was Brenda Kay, and how she came toward me and away from Billie Jean, while all else in the world shuffled along, dead to the 6 feet my daughter moved across. Brenda Kay fell into my arms, and I held her to me. "Mama, Mama." It was her only word so far, and I heard her say it again and again. Then other sounds came to me. Billie Jean, still seated on the floor on the other side of the rug, was clapping. Next came the rush and pounding that could only be my boys on the stairs down. Once they reached the bottom, Wilma said, "What's going on?" Anne was up and coming toward Brenda Kay and me, her arms out, the red pencil still in one hand. She hugged the two of us as best she could, Annie growing up and 8 now, older suddenly than I wanted her to be. "I saw it, I saw it." I felt her hold us tighter, Brenda Kay tucked between us. Burton was still one step up, his hand on the railing, Wilman in front of him. Billie Jean turned to them. "She walked! She walked!" That was when I heard Leston's chair push back, heard his steps across the floor and toward us all, the boys now down with the rest of us. But they were with us, and I felt him pat my shoulders, saw him touch Brenda Kay's head and arms and back. I looked behind me, saw Leston in the doorway, hands wrapped around the coffee cup. Finally, he smiled. He nodded, the move slow and measured, his mouth never opening. Then he knelt next to me, and he kissed my cheek, moved his face into my hair. He said nothing, but what he'd given was more than he'd offered and longer than I cared to recall. A kiss, his face close to mine. Only that, but I was happy with it. Leston stood. I watched him move back to the doorway where he stopped, turned around, and leaned against the door jamb, the coffee cup still in his hands. His eyes were on Brenda Kay. He was smiling and brought the cup to his lips. Brenda Kay started churning in my arms, excited at all these goings on, walking, clapping, laughing. Her mouth was open and taking in too many breaths, and she tried to clap, her eyes on the children. Her hands came together twice, then missed, came together again. Walking at 5 years and 6 months, her word mama coming at 4 and 1 month, out of diapers only 5 months ago. She lifted her head at 1 year, rolled over at 2. Leston's kiss to me, his face in my hair, signaled to me what all we'd sacrifice so that I could tend to my baby. His heart had been gone for some time now, and I can't say as I blame him for it. When the war was over, Pascagoula seemed to shut down altogether, like there was a gate into the place and nobody'd open it for him. And that good, clear money we'd had for so long might as well have been only a dream we'd all carried on for years. Because we woke one morning in September of 1945 and looked at each other while the sounds of the house started up like every morning. But the look we'd given each other wasn't anything like the one we'd had the morning I told him I was pregnant with Brenda Kay. This look was one of bewilderment. Neither of us certain what was going to happen to the baby in the cradle next to us. That morning, there was no money and no prospect of it. The shots cost money, $23 each time, and the doctor visits cost money, $2 each time, and the trips into New Orleans every 3 months cost money. And now we had no money. We had 5 steers and 3 cows by that time. What money we'd been able to squirrel away and not put back into the stump business invested in them. We sold off the 2 steers, then the rest of the cattle, one by one, while nothing like a real job came close to Leston. Finally, J.E. and Toxie stopped showing up, and I'd taken the job at the grammar school, and the boys and Annie took to selling vegetables from my garden out front of the house, all to pay for what I'd committed us to with my words to Dr. Beaudry on a morning what seemed decades ago. But it was a life we were saving, I told myself enough nights after that, when Leston started staying up with his coffee, just staring out the window above the kitchen sink, where I found him every time I came downstairs and begged him back to bed. And it was a life we were saving, I told myself enough days the children went on to school and clothes mended and patched so many times that there was no telling what was the original material and what I'd been able to pick up at the piece goods store. It was a life we were after. I thought enough times we got checks from James, me feeling guilty for the gift of the money from a son trying to put himself through college, him a married man now, married to a Texas girl named Eudine and putting himself through Texas A&M. Guilty because each time I got a check from him, I felt relief, as though the only good thing I felt for my firstborn and his wife was thanks for the money they sent. But it was a life we were after. It was a life we were saving, and with the checks James managed to squeeze out to us, with the money from Billie Jean, with the money from the Kenlin and the grammar school, even the change from the vegetable stand outside, we'd managed to get here, to this day, a Saturday picnic to celebrate Brenda Kay's first steps. 5 years, when they said she lived too. 6 feet across the front room floor when they said she'd never walk. But there was something else I was looking for, too, something I wanted to try out on Leston. I was ready to talk to Leston about something I'd figured on changing our world, all for the better. I wanted to talk to my husband, the man who it seemed for all intents and purposes had pulled up stakes in this family, given up in the face of his baby daughter and the fact of no jobs. That evening, I stood in the quiet of a nighttime kitchen, and I decided right then I'd try out the word I wanted to use on Leston. I'd offer him the word, one I hadn't yet uttered aloud, too afraid of the sound it'd make, and maybe how far off and ridiculous the idea might seem. I decided I'd try the word out on him, because he was my husband, no matter how deep that well he'd fallen into, no matter how hard he was gasping for air inside God's will for his life. He was still my husband, and I was still his wife. California. I tried it again. California. It was in the Reader's Digest I found out about it. That was the only magazine I let come into the house, and I'd kept it a secret. That money I spent on it. Cathedral was the only one who knew about it, her taking care of Brenda Kay when I was out to the grammar school. The mail came near 1:30 each day, and I was usually home by that time to get it. Cathedral my only witness as I tore off the crisp brown wrapper. My Reader's Digest, the highlight of the month. It took me elsewhere, let me think of myself as someone still able to learn a thing or three about the world. When I was through with the magazines, I gave them to Cathedral, who seemed genuinely to want them, her thin hands holding each issue as if it were a precious photograph, only touching the edges, holding it back and away from her, admiring the paintings on the back. But the last two issues, I hadn't given up to her. Each of them containing an article about what was called mongoloids, and I was thankful right from the start that someone, somewhere, finally taken out the second word, that the word idiot and all it carried had been cut off. The first story was about a woman who decided to give up her mongoloid child to a special home in a place called Vineland, New Jersey, and it was the hardest decision she ever made, but it was all for the best of the child. I didn't much care for the article because it went against everything I'd tried to make for Brenda Kay. A loving household, proper medical treatment, good care while I was out of the house and making money for that treatment. What made me keep hold of that issue, though, was the note at the end of the article, set off in a little box. In the next issue, Reader's Digest reports on a new miracle drug that helps increase IQ in brain food for the backward child. Don't miss it. I wouldn't. That article was the story of a mongoloid boy named David who tested in with an IQ of 49, but after taking medicine from doctors at the Columbia School of Medicine, had it shoot up to 61, and he was reading now, and he was improving. I had no idea what IQ Brenda Kay would have, didn't know anything about the Columbia School of Medicine other than it was in New York City, didn't have any idea how much more than calcium gluconate shots this whole procedure cost. But what I knew was that something out there was holding hope. And so when I got to the end of the article and saw the boxed message there, I read it with a new and different kind of hope. Hope that maybe there was something out there could help me fix what was going on in our lives. The burden here. Reader's Digest suggests that if you would like more information about care for the retarded child, clip out the coupon below and mail it to the National Association for Retarded Children, P.O. Box 1712, Los Angeles, California. Below the box was a small form, lines for our address, the name of our child, how old she was. Of course I stood, got one of Annie's red pencils. I filled out the form. The next morning, as soon as Cathedral got there, I left, headed for the 5 and dime for an envelope, then to the post office, had that coupon on its way to California, and whoever it was would have to hand out help from that far away. California. I had to make my husband see the truth and promise that seemed to shine out from that word. I saw that there was no means of escape except to take the years handed you, make them your own by holding them tight and wringing from them all you could. I'd attended Pearl River Community College on a scholarship from the Mississippi Institutional School for Girls and become a teacher in a one-room school in East Columbia, Mississippi. I'd just started at the school, had attended the East Columbia Church there only 2 Sundays. That second Sunday, one Miss Lavina Hilburn had thought it her Christian duty to introduce herself to me and offer me an empty room in her house, one that had been recently vacated by her son Leston, who'd headed out to Macomb to work in a lumber mill. Miss Hilburn was a heavy woman, but kind all the same. Her eyes a beautiful clear green, a green I couldn't know then would be a green I would see the rest of my days. Then a tall, thin young man came up behind Miss Hilburn, touched her shoulder, and nodded to me as she turned around. "This here is Leston, my boy, the one whose room's empty and waiting you to come and live in, if you see that as being the Lord's will." She turned back to me, and Leston put out his hand. "Ma'am?" I hesitated, not certain what it would mean, a brand new schoolteacher shaking hands with an unmarried man, but I shook it all the same, felt the calluses on his fingers, his palm. There'd been no more thought of him than that, a green-eyed boy who worked a lumber mill in Macomb. I looked to Miss Hilburn, fanning herself now with the bamboo fan. I wondered how best to find out how much she wanted to rent the room for, and how that amount would seal whether or not it was the Lord's will for me to stay with her. But I hadn't had to ask. She said, $2 a week is all. Is that the Lord's will? It is. We laughed. Her son was already gone. I hadn't even seen him go. I moved in that afternoon with everything I owned, which wasn't much. My second dress, my underclothes, a few books, the fountain pen I'd received upon graduating from the Mississippi Industrial School for Girls, tablets of paper, a red pencil, a photograph. And as I got to know Leston, even before the mill closed and he moved back into the house, I saw that he was a good man, true-hearted, and I'd come to love him. That night, after Brenda Kay took her first steps, Leston and I made love, the first time in a long time. Maybe that's why it seemed so close to that first time on a honeymoon, as close as I could imagine, yet different, changed. This time I found comfort in the ghosts my sounds brought forth, sounds that now too Leston gave out. We two in our 40s and making love like the children we were that first night. There was comfort in the ghosts of my parents, some sort of reconciliation, peace in the unformed words Leston and I made, me understanding suddenly what it must have been like for my own mother to make love each Saturday night to a man who'd already left her, a man she might never get back. And I wondered if my being here now, him deep inside me, my arms around his shoulders, my mouth kissing his forehead, I might bring Leston back from across the deep chasm that had formed since Brenda Kay'd been born, from the dark world he lived nights, sullen with the knowledge he had no work, that his children were growing up in a way, his wife's life filled with a retarded child and the cold knowledge that the daughter he'd fathered would never be right, never be just a girl. A beautiful, normal girl named for Leston's beautiful sister. But then the other purpose took shape in me, twisted itself into form and being. So lying there in bed with my husband, I began. Leston, we can do better by our family. They were the only words came to me for all the thinking I'd done on how to tell him. Leston's hand, rubbing my back, went still. How so? I have an idea that we ought to think on moving from here, from Purvis, from maybe Mississippi. He pulled his hand away. You want to move to New Orleans? Or thereabouts, Jewel, driving into New Orleans every few weeks to see a doctor don't make it necessary to move there. I reached for him. Not New Orleans, but to a place where Brenda Kay can get what she needs, a place where there's an opportunity for things. Things for all of us. Things, he said. Things. Like good care. Like something akin to a school. Like maybe a school or something for Brenda Kay. I swallowed again. Jobs, too. Good jobs. He squinted at me in the dark. Who put these big ideas in your head? No one. The Reader's Digest is a place in California where... California. The word didn't sound the same coming from his mouth. I tried again. California's where there's a school for mongoloids. I stopped, my last word big and clumsy and strange. A word that cut off whatever others were lined up in me. Stopped them all. All I could hear was the ringing in my ears, the loud rush of blood through me that choked out everything else as I ran through the halls of the same hospital my baby Brenda Kay'd been born in. Just ahead of me, Willman, his strides long and easy, a man now near on tall as Leston. He slowed down, pointed to an open door to our left,
and I let go his hand, went on into the room without waiting for breath, without waiting for the ringing to stop. Inside were doctors and nurses all huddled round the bed, but as I came near, they parted, stood aside for me. I didn't even look at them, only at the bed and at Brenda Kay lying there.
My mama, my mama.
Her arms went up to me, and I saw that her eyebrows had been scorched off. Me still knowing so little of what happened, only the few words Wilmond forced out to me on the ride from the cafeteria here, only that there had been a fire and that Brenda Kay'd been burned. I'm here, honey. I'm here. I'm right here. As I hugged her, held her tight to me, I listened to her crying, heard her sob in a new way I'd never heard from her before. A cry too deep, too strong. And I thanked my God I could be here and found myself cursing him in the very same breath. I held her. She fell asleep in my arms, whimpering in her sleep, and when I finally let her go, the sound of her whimpering was thick in the air. The soft and quick moan she gave out blasting to pieces finally that ringing in my ears. Even as the doctor started in on telling me what had happened, it seemed the words were only being built around my Brenda Kay's pain. Every whimper she gave blotted out a phrase or two of what healing I could hope for, what the chances of her legs being usable again were, how long before skin might come back. Not until one of those nurses took hold of my hand, and as one of the doctors pulled back the sheet that lay across Brenda Kay, did things come alive for me. What I saw. Her legs had been burned up to mid-thigh, her right worse than the left, blackened skin rumpled and bunched on the top and sides. Her left leg wasn't as badly burned, but the skin there too was bunched and blistered where the fire had crept. From mid-shin to just above a knee, skin gray and red and mottled, already oozing. Then her smell came to me. The smell of burnt flesh, the sour smoldering and stink of her lying there. My baby. Cathedral was the one to blame, because blame was what I was after. She'd been watching over Brenda Kay like every day I'd worked at the cafeteria. My children had all been at school or work themselves. Cathedral was sweeping up in the boys' old bedroom, Wilman the only one living there now. Burton'd moved out to California 5 months before to find whatever fortune he thought was there. That idea of California planted by me, through all the quiet conversations I'd had with Leston on the subject. Me talking at him from across the kitchen table in the middle of the night for the last 3 years, and Burton had overheard. He graduated from Purvis High and worked a summer at the ice cream plant in Columbia, and took in enough money to buy a run-down pickup truck and move. Nothing to it. Just pure and cold resolve in my son, and I couldn't help but envy him, and at the same time feel glad I'd handed him on something I could lay claim to, that resolve. He'd gotten a job out there right off, working at a muffler shop welding mufflers onto cars. All the thousands and thousands of bright and new and perfect cars he saw out there every day. Now and again he sent a dress to Billie Jean or Annie or Brenda Kay, and postcards once a week of piers and seagulls and violet mountains and short green trees clustered with bright oranges. And I'd gotten a hat, burgundy with a tiny veil across the front brim. I hadn't yet had enough nerve to wear it into our church, where I could just imagine the words that passed between women. The mother of a retarded child strutting in with a hat like that, I swan. And, too, he sent his daddy a lighter, a brass and stainless steel lighter Leston carried with him everywhere he went, even in the pocket of his pale green coveralls, his uniform for work at the ice cream plant. He worked piling 50-pound sacks of sugar onto pallets 5 days a week now, the job his son had left behind. Though Leston hadn't approved of Burton's moving, Leston carried that lighter with him to work every day, filled it every morning with lighter fluid from the thin blue and yellow can he kept on the mantel. It was a beautiful lighter, and I wondered often enough how much money Burton really made out there in all that sun and in amongst all those cars. but mostly I wondered when my husband was going to roll over and give in to what was so clearly best for my family, so clearly best for Brenda Kay. That lighter, I figured, was a fine start, a piece of California in his coveralls every day, there in his hand with every cigarette he lit. That same resolve in Burton was what made James a good example of what you could do when you took hold of your life, made it do what you wanted of it. He was in veterinarian school at A&M now, would be out next summer practicing on his own. And I had a grandchild, too, baby Judy, after Eugene's mother. A baby girl with fiery red hair and green eyes yet again, and who I hadn't yet held. When we'd gotten the phone call near 3 a.m. one morning 10 months ago, James, breathless on the other end, the line crackling with interference at some point between here and Texas, I'd said right off to him, "Count 'em up. Count up her fingers and toes. Make sure there's 10 of each." But right then I'd felt the hollow promise that measure really meant. My Brenda Cade had 10 of each. Every time I asked one of my children again how the burn had happened, I could see Cathedral giving out the story, saw her stone still, except for the small words she formed, eyes half opened, her face all straight as she gave to them what she reckoned was God's will in this situation. She'd been sweeping and heard Brenda Kay scream, dropped the broom right there, ran downstairs to see Brenda Kay standing in front of the hearth with fire swarming up her legs. Brenda Kay screamed and screamed and took to running. Cathedral chased her through the front room and on into the kitchen, managed to pull her down from behind and lay on her a moment until the flames had gone out. Cathedral herself ended up with blistered skin on her right thigh, her thin cotton dress scorched, her heavy leggings keeping her skin from burning any worse. Then Cathedral poured cold January water over the burned flesh, laid blankets over Brenda Kay, laid as many as she could and ran out to the road, started waving down any car passing by out there. Not one car stopped for a half hour. 7 cars passing her by as she screamed and hollered and waved. It was a nigger finally to stop for her. Eliza Campbell, the insurance salesman, one of only 3 niggers in the county who had a car to drive. My baby'd passed out by then from the shock and the pain. Eliza Campbell, the one to drive her to this hospital. Cathedral in the back seat with Brenda Kay's head in her lap, stroking her hair, stroking it. They got her to the hospital and Cathedral told the nurse who my daughter was, told her Wilman was a junior at Purvis High, that he should be called first, that he could handle it all from then. She drove with Eliza Campbell back to the house to clean things up, to get ready, she told my children. And the first thing she saw when she came back in the house was that thin blue and yellow can of lighter fluid. Empty, scorched, the pain bubbled like the skin on my baby's legs. Around it, scorched black bricks, the black leading a trail into the fireplace, the fire now only embers. Brenda Cade reached up to the mantel and pulled the lighter fluid down and had squirted it all over everywhere and had been taken up by flames jumping out the fireplace. It was a wonder that our home didn't burn down to the ground. "A blessing from God above," were the words Cathedral used each time she told the story to my children. Why didn't she call me that morning? I wondered that every time I heard the story. We had a telephone there in the house, too. Why didn't she call? But I never asked out loud, because I knew the answer. Blame had fallen square on her, and she'd known it. Cathedral hadn't tended properly to my child, hadn't kept her out of reach of the lighter fluid, hadn't called me away from ladling out dumplings and gravy to children at Bailey Grammar School while my own retarded child burned at my home. Blame was hers, hard and pure and cold. I stayed in that hospital room with Brenda Kay for a month, through all the changing of the dressings on her legs, through all the whimpering and crying, through the stench rotten skin gave off. I stayed for a month in the hospital room, doctors saying she'd take pneumonia, that she'd not walk again, that she'd be lucky if gangrene didn't settle in.
The day she went home, Brenda Kay was lifted from a bed and eased into a wheelchair by two nigger orderlies, boys who reminded me too much of Cathedral's own, Sepulchre and Temple, the two who carried me only to deliver this child in this wretched hospital. And as Leston and Wilman lifted her into the cab of the truck, settled there, her whimpering all the way through, I didn't even turn back to look at the place. I knew I didn't ever want to see it again. Leston was even more the stranger now, even older the man. He said nothing to Brenda Kay the entire ride home, knuckles white as they gripped and regripped the steering wheel. It was a Tuesday morning, and he'd taken off from work for this, had on the green coveralls he wore, his name stitched in white thread above his shirt pocket, coveralls a little too big on him, so that he seemed that much smaller, that much thinner. He was a stricken man, dumbfounded by what had been tossed at him yet again, but that didn't give him any more reason than the next of us to spend the rest of his days pondering the universe in a coffee cup, not coming to our bed and to his wife. We'd only made love a handful of times since the night Brenda Kay first walked, and each time I took him into my arms, he felt frailer, his skin a touch more toward paper. He had a heart, had love for his daughter, had compassion on us all, but I saw he let the grief and bewilderment he carried overwhelm him, blind him to the truth that the world, our world, had to make sea changes in order to get right again, or at least as close to right as we'd ever get. But now there was no more time I could spend in persuading him. Now we were gone, headed to California with or without him. I was upstairs when I heard it, the knock at the back door. I went to the attic window, tried to see through the dirty glass who it would be, though I already knew. Down in the kitchen, I saw Cathedral's outline through the curtains, and the flush of my own pain took me over, and I saw my hand shake at the knob. I opened the door. There she stood, smiling, smiling and smiling, though in her eyes was some piece of sorrow. She had her hair covered with a worn-out blue handkerchief, had a beat old yellow sweater over her shoulders against the February cold out there, the only button left on it the one at the neck. I stood looking at her a long moment, felt her too familiar to me. I knew she'd be the one who'd somehow end up laying open to me the fact I was forsaking the heart of my husband to further the good of my retarded daughter. That knowledge coming to me in just that moment, in no time really, and then I realized that the sweater she wore was one of my old ones, a sweater I'd given her years ago when times were good, and when we'd fed nigger after nigger at our back door, and when they'd all followed my strong and handsome husband off into the woods to help the United States win the war. She looked at me out the corners of her eyes and waited. My hands were at my sides, dead, useless, and I took my eyes from her. "I'm sorry, Miss Jewel, but you got to think on Job. You got to think on David and him fighting the anointed Saul." She paused. "You got to think on Christ." That was my sweater she had on. "The Lord trying his best to smile down on you, child, but you not letting him do that." Before I could think of anything else I could do, any words or gestures or silences, I drew back my hand and I brought it full force across this nigger woman's face. And that moment all I ever fought against exploded in me. I knew then I was no better than my grandmother knew no matter how hard you prayed, no matter how shiny the stones in your pockets, no matter how far behind you thought your old lives were, they were never gone. I saw you never gave up who you were or where you'd been in your life. I'd refuse to let Missy Cook try and reconcile herself to me just as right now as refusing Cathedral. And as I felt the pain in my hand, suddenly Missy Cook was only a sad and lonely old woman choking to death on the dry crust of her own history. And now here was my own history. The dry crust of blame I wanted forced from me in the form of my hand slapping hard the black flesh of Cathedral's cheek. And then I remembered what I'd done after Missy Cook had hit me, how I'd simply turned my other cheek to her, offered up myself to her, daring her to strike me, which was the only thing Cathedral did. Once I'd struck her, she closed her eyes, took in a quick breath between clenched teeth. She seemed to fill up her lungs with that breath, held it, then gave her head a quick shake as if to rid herself of the pain I'd given her. Then she opened her eyes, smiled again, and turned her other cheek to me. That was when I turned from her, stepped inside. I pushed the door closed, then twisted the knob until it locked. I leaned my back against the door, held my hands at my chest. I looked around at all we had in the kitchen. The plain white china and three vases in the glass cupboards above the sink, spoils from those war years, a fine oak table built by Leston, the wall clock that chimed on the half hour, a wedding gift from Leston's mother and father. I looked at everything we could sell and make money from, already trying to gauge in my head how much closer each item might bring us to California. I heard behind me the slow steps of Cathedral as she moved down the steps, off our property and toward her own, and though I hadn't known it, I found myself crying, saw the room and its contents shimmer in my eyes. Jewel? Jewel, wake up. I opened my eyes to the dark of the bedroom, to the cold and empty side of the bed that had once been Leston's. I ran my hand across the sheets, felt nothing, wondered if I'd only dreamed his voice. Jewel. I saw his shadow standing next to my side of the bed, at his face the bright ember of a cigarette, the only light here. Get up. Then he turned, left the room. A moment later, I heard his footsteps down the stairs. I sat up. Brenda Kay. It was May already, dressing still tight on her thighs and on her one calf, but there'd been no gangrene after all, no pneumonia to kill off my baby, so I didn't know what was wrong. I climbed out of bed, grabbed my robe from the footboard, moved quick to the stairs and down. Brenda Kay was asleep there in the front room, her mouth partway open like always as she took in deep and steady breaths. I turned, saw Leston sitting at the kitchen table, hands around a coffee mug. I walked to the kitchen to join him, but his eyes stayed fixed high on the wall opposite him. At first I thought he was only staring, lost in whatever thoughts he had, thoughts I'd long given up on trying to understand. Then he nodded at the wall, and I saw what he was on to. I turned, looked, saw the empty space where, until yesterday, had hung the wall clock. His eyes were hard. My mom and daddy gave that to us. They're both dead now. I'd known this moment was heading at me, but had only put away any thoughts of it, certain I'd be able to piece my way through it no matter what. His eyes were on me. You think I don't see what's going on in my own house, do you? His hands fell away from around the cup, lay flat on the table. A cigarette stub was jammed between two fingers of his left hand, and he brought it to his lips, pulled hard on it. At least tell me what you got for it. I wouldn't take my eyes from the cigarette. I got $12. He laughed, a quick shrug of his shoulders and a shake of his head. Let's see, the clock, four quilts, all the boys' old things. Most all the tomatoes and raspberries and okra and pickles and corn you put up last year. And there's the two vases gone, the two dresses Burton sent Brenda Kay. He stopped, leaned across the table. Anything I missed? Or is there more I couldn't come up with? I pulled back from him, afraid. He wasn't anyone I knew. He kept on. What is it you figure I do down here? You think I sit here, my ass tied tight to a chair? You think I don't walk through my house at night? Find my way through dark to closets and cupboards? You figure I can't see what the hell's going on all around me? How you're selling us out piece by piece to some goddamn dream of moving to California? I could see the faint sheen of sweat on his forehead, veins in his neck straining. It's not a dream, Leston. It's going to happen whether you want it to or not. I closed my eyes, listening to the voice of this stranger.
So how much you get so far? All sales put together, how much you get for your little jaunt out to sunny California?
I knew the number by heart, kept the tab running with each item that left our house. $73.37. I opened my eyes, saw him lean back again.
Seems to me you think you can wrestle the world and win.
Ain't so.
Simple as that.
Seems if you want to change the world, you might ought to get hold of a few more dollars than that. He picked up a cigarette he just rolled, gave it a small toss, watched it land back in his hand.
So I want you to see this. Wanted you to come on downstairs here and watch your husband do what he's about to do, so you'll be able to go at this California whole hog.
Well, I figured the only true way out of here is through raising big dollars, not nickel and diming your way there.
Now he had out the brass lighter Burton had sent him. He started flicking the lighter lid open and closed, open and closed. He flicked it open one last time, then clicked the flint, shot up the flame, held it on.
Guess in your head I'm most to blame. Me and my can of lighter fluid's to blame for what's happened. For all the rotten smells in this house and all the tears. Because even though you struck down Cathedral, I know you still figure it's my fault. The way I see it, if it hadn't been for that can, we wouldn't be here right now having this little talk.
Though I wouldn't tell it to his face, he was wrong. I hadn't put any blame on him. No other blame than the fact he'd pulled out of this family years ago. The truth was, we'd been on the road to this night since we'd sat in the cab of the truck on a rainy day almost 9 years ago, just down the stairs from Dr. Beaudry's office in that first examination. We'd been on our way to this table since Leston had flicked on the wipers in a sad attempt to make clear the world we were entering. But I only nodded my head to his question, wanted him on with this.
Look at me.
I lifted my head, felt my legs set to trembling. He brought the lighter to the cigarette, the flame twisted to high. He closed his eyes, drew in on the cigarette, let out a small puff of smoke. He brought down the lighter left on the flame.
You're selling everything off, everything we own. But to my figuring, there's only two things we own you can't sell off.
Only two things. He let go of the flame, snapped the lid closed. He held the lighter with two fingers, turned it back and forth.